American songwriter, we had the opportunity to talk to Chantel Kroviasek of Moon vs. Sun over Zoom video. Chantel tells us about being born and raised in Winnipeg in Canada and how she was born with perfect pitch. She could hear something at church or on Sesame Street at 2-3 years old, walk over to the piano and play it back perfectly. So she was just destined to do. If she didn't want to do music, she was going to have to do music. It's that ingrained into her DNA. She tells us about getting signed to Columbia Records at a very early age, being flown to Los Angeles, put in these huge studios, put on big, huge tours, and how she met her husband, Rain Maida, of Our Lady Peace, at a Pearl Jam show in Toronto. Chantel talks about collaborating with her husband, you know, whether it be with her stuff or Our Lady Peace or his solo projects, and just always kind of working together, but never working on a project together. So she tells us all about this documentary and record they put out for Moon vs. Sun. It's called I'm Going to Break Your Heart. She talks about how her and her husband, just the two of them, they didn't bring the kids, took a trip to this isolated island near France so they could sit and write an entire record together. So she talks about the film, the album, working together, where they were during the pandemic and how that, you know, the isolation of the documentary kind of prepared them for what eventually happened with the entire world shutting down and the future plans for Moon vs. Sun. You can watch the interview with Chantel and myself on our Facebook page and YouTube channel. It'd be awesome if you subscribe to our YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards and like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Bringing Back Pod.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're Bringing It Backwards with Moon vs. Sun. Awesome. So this is all about you and your journey in music. How you got to where you are now. Well, I know you have an extensive solo career and obviously, and then this whole making of this record and Moon vs. Sun and the there's like a documentary behind it. I'd love to hear all about it.
Yeah. So, wow. I wouldn't really know to be. That's a loaded question.
Where were you born and raised? Let's start there.
Yeah, I was going to say I was born and raised in a place called Winnipeg, Canada, which is the coldest place of its populace on the planet besides Siberia.
Interesting.
And so you're inside a lot, I think, probably in the winter. I mean, we do really embrace the winter vibes, especially as children. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a hardy stock. But there's a lot of music. I don't know if there's more music. You know, because I wasn't raised somewhere else too. I didn't have a parallel dimension, but
sure.
The thing about me that is, you know, and it's something now, I'm older now, so I feel like I can be a little bit objective. You know, people come to me often and they say, oh, how do you do that? Like, how are you in the business? And I've always been in the music business. I've always been somehow, working as a musician, as a singer, as a songwriter, in theater, doing something TV, something, right? Mm-hmm. And I say to people that I don't think that there is any code. I don't think there's any, you know, model that works. And I think that, you know, people can have, you have to have some luck, but I think that some people have extraordinary luck. And at some point it's all luck, because what you're born with is your luck in your life, you know. But my luck, I think, began with the fact that, you know, as a child, from a very, very young age, probably approximately 2 or 3, I could play anything back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had perfect pitch. I've always had perfect pitch, and I could play anything back. So that by the time I was 7 years old, 6 years old, 8 years old, if we went to the movies and came home, everybody knew I would go into the piano room and I'd be playing the score of the film that we were just at. Like, that's who I was. Wow. I was on a children's music oriented show from when I was little. That was sort of a big thing. And there was a major network in Canada back then called CTV.
Uh-huh.
And this aired on Western Canada CTV. So everything from Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, British Columbia. I was on a show.
Okay.
It wasn't in Eastern Canada.
Interesting.
But, yeah. So I was up at a microphone in a studio singing songs, you know, that they were written by someone else. But I was writing songs from when I was very little. When I was a little girl and my mom would put me to sleep at night, I remember she would sit on my bed and she would read to me. And then she didn't sing to me. I sang to her the songs I was writing. So
Wow. Yeah.
And also, my dad came from a second generation farm that, you know, my Ukrainian, basically refugee parent, grandparents, you know, had established, my great grandparents. And there was an old piano in there, an old piano. And my dad, when my Gigi, my grandfather, inherited the farm, he and my Baba had 13 kids.
Oh my gosh.
They kept 12. One they gave away in the hospital because the lady had lost her baby. So my Baba had twins, so she gave one away. That's how many children they had. Too many mouths to feed.
Yeah.
But they
I've never heard that story before. Wow.
They were very religious. Oh yeah, my dad found him, but he still doesn't go up to him. He just drives by his house and he feels uncomfortable to disrupt his life, but he did find him. But anyway, so my family, my dad's family, they were very religious people, and they had a piano. It's an old piano, and it's still there. And our family, someone in the family always has the farmhouse, you know, and it gets sort of passed around. And everyone was always around that piano. And I was always the last one at the piano. And I would play the hymns. There were hymns there. And by the way, I was always studying music too. My parents noticed I was obviously freakishly born with my abilities. And mm-hmm. so they had me in what was called the Royal Conservatory of Music. It's based on a British system of study of music, which I believe is absolutely fantastic for technical skills. Mm-hmm. So that, coupled with my personal imagination for music and creativity, I think is the equation of me. Now, the other thing is that my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, were a duo.
Really?
So my grandfather, Walter, he played the fiddle, and my grandmother, Isabel, played the mouth harp, it was called. Not singing harmonica, but the mouth harp. And my first memory of my life is I'm sitting on my grandma's knee under the phone. You know, the phone's used to be on the wall. And I'm leaning on my grandmother, and I'm trying to think. No, I'm on my grandpa, sitting on my grandpa's knee, and he's somehow playing a fiddle and bopping me on his knee, I guess. And my grandmother is across from him on a chair in front of the fridge. You know those chairs that they're like that horrible plastic. They crack. You know the old chairs.
Oh right.
I'll step out now, whatever. But anyway. And they're playing together. They're in a duo. My grandparents used to play during the Prohibition. They'd go to the hall and they'd be the entertainment. People would leave money in the jar. People would bring their own alcohol at the hall. So, So my first memory is literally, I am sitting, literally sandwiched in a duo. And now I'm, you know, 45 years later, I'm a duo. I'm part of a duo. And it's with my husband. And my husband's grandfather was also named Walter. So we have all these cute, you know.
That's amazing.
Things. But anyway, so that's my story. And then I was always kind of, for a long time, I was the weird kid that, like, if there was, you know, my choir teacher at school, goes, Chantal, can you sing a C, please? Mrs. Honey isn't here today to play the piano.
So you'd have to be the, you'd have to be the keyboard fill-in.
Yeah, and then I was the one. You weren't supposed to have the lead in the elementary school play until you were in sixth grade, because that's your graduating year from sixth grade, you know, from elementary. But I had the lead in fifth and sixth grade.
Oh.
And,
so, you
know, and then the kids were mean to me and I got bullied. And then the whole school got a talking to about bullying because of me.
Wow. You know? Oh, so it was almost like a blessing and a curse kind of
that
for
was
you.
Terrible. And the thing is, it's hard because I'm watching our kids. But you know what? Things can be hard. Things can be easy. There's no prediction of why something's going to work out. But I watch with our kids and it's like, I have one son that he's incredibly talented as a musician as well. Like that's his, you know, clearly he's that, but
it's in the genes. He plays
sports. And I have to tell you, I appreciate sports as a parent in the family dynamic because with arts, there's no schedule. Mm-hmm. The schedule of arts is go out in the world and mess up and be in pain. And you're left your own devices, and that's where your art comes from, your pain.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a parent, you want to protect your child, and so you don't want an artist in a way. You know, like, I don't know, is it possible to be like, oh yeah, my child, 15, 14 year old's a brilliant artist and she's not fucked up at all? Like, I don't know. Right. I don't know that. I feel like, you know, I'd be better to say, you know, he's playing a high level of basketball. He's also talented. Let's see where that goes. And just get some, you know, some regimen and some structure and take it from there. I don't know. It's a frightening world, especially for kids now. So I don't know if I would recommend it, but it was hard for me then. Whereas my husband, if I might speak for him, he loved music, but he was older when he first decided to master, you know, the guitar and start songwriting. He fell in love with bands.
Mm-hmm.
See, in my head, I already was a band.
Okay.
Like, since I was born, you know? And like, I was writing songs from when I was very little. There was not much of a teacher for me or something I sought after. No one was famous where I was from. Mm-hmm. The most famous person was Monty Hall. And he was the game show host for Let's Make a Deal.
Yeah, I know who he is. No one was famous.
And so there was no fame coming, you know? It wasn't like that. Whereas my husband was from Toronto, and there were plenty of, you know, I mean, my God, some of the most famous comedians in the world and musicians.
A lot of talent out of Toronto.
Right. I mean, we used to love to say in Winnipeg that Neil Young went to a year of high school at Kelvin High School. And like, that made the high school so cool, you know. But I mean, did anyone really ever see Neil Young? I don't know. Of course, we also had BTO, Backman Turner Overdrive, and Burton Cummings. That was something that was kind of a thing too. But yeah, there really wasn't a lot of like, hey, go after this, you'll be famous. Or hey, listen to this and you'll want to be like that. I was raised in the church, sang hymns, and sort of, it was called like, not soul music. It was called, what's the word they would use for spiritual music? I can't even remember. Like Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant, you know, those were the big camp rebel. Like, I don't know.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And my mom had one that she loved to listen to named Evie. And I loved her. And then also in my house, my mom and dad liked, you know, John Lennon and Yoko's Double Fantasy. And, then there was pop music, and I had cousins who listened to crazy best 60s, 70s music. But then we also had to go to the church one night and learn about Led Zeppelin, how when you play it backwards, Stairway to Heaven backwards, that it's the devil, like the devil's talking. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. I've heard that about a few songs. Isn't there a Beatles song that they said that to? Or like,
but see, and that's funny you say that, because like, it's so stupid. Like, you know, mom and dad are listening to Double Fantasy by John and Yoko over here, but John's band, no.
Right.
But yeah, and so then my brothers were rebels if they listened to Black Sabbath or, you know, Judas Priest. So I had a lot coming at me, and, you know, Fleetwood Mac with my girl cousins and lots of good stuff. But I, for example, never got into Carole King or even Joni till much later. It was a pretty mostly male dominated experience of music, but really rich. I think really rich. And a lot of that, to circle back to the original thing about how, you know, the luck of it, you know, to circle back to that, the truth is that honestly, a lot of what I am today and how it happened is because it was inside of me. You know, to this day, I do not like to listen to tons of music because I have something inside of me that I want to come out. It's, you know, and I always feel like if I listen to too much music, then I'm going to just make that because I'm a mimic with my ear. You know what I mean? So that's the danger for me. I have both going on.
Yeah, because you have that perfect pitch and you can remember the notes.
Yes!
So it's almost like, am I copying something I had already heard?
Exactly. So I like to, you know, I have just an absolute penchant for like whatever my OG is inside of me. I mean, my husband will get so annoyed with me because we'll be driving and I'll just be like, oh, kill me. Can I take a separate vehicle? Because I can't listen to a singer-songwriter. I just can't do it. I can't do it. And it's caused some serious rows in our, you know, in our otherwise perfect relationship.
Sure. Well, I love that you guys are doing this as a husband and wife duo, because yeah. This podcast started with my wife and I. We do the interviews together, but now since COVID happened, we have two kids also. So right. It's like somebody's got to play, you know, referee in the other room.
That's a lot better than what I thought you were going to say. Now since COVID, we can't stand each other. And it's kind of, you know, not happy.
Yeah, since COVID, I picked up and left, got a different apartment. No. Yeah, it's just
the sparse look behind you, very bachelor cave. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh well, it's because we just moved to Nashville like a month ago.
Okay.
So people are like, "What's going on in there?" I'm like, "It's just been
just not a lot yet.
We just haven't had a chance though. Yeah, we're in the process of unloading everything we still own and moved from Southern California here. So,
hey, I believe you, man. I believe you.
right. That's what I've been telling people, at least.
Looks good. Everything's going to be okay, man.
That's what everyone keeps telling me. Just kidding. I'm curious on the perfect pitch. You know, having that, I mean, it's obviously amazing and what a gift. But also, like being a kid, or even in, like you said, you got the lead in fifth and sixth grade, like having to listen to people sing off key or people trying to cover songs that you know are like not even close. Was that ever something that were like irritating? I don't know.
I think there's a difference between having perfect pitch and being able to perform perfect pitch.
Okay.
You know. Like, and let me try to explain that to you. So like if somebody sings and they're like, or I hear a song and, you know, it's, you know, we were talking about Double Fantasy and let's say I heard, you know, Woman, I can only express. I've never been to. That on the piano that I can remember.
But you can just do it right there.
And I just do it. So my perfect pitch has a lot more, in my opinion, to do with like I can mess with anything and just.
That's so fantastic.
So if you just said, "Oh yeah, there's that new song, blah blah blah," I just play it for you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you can hear it already, and you can just figure out on the piano where exactly it sits.
It's a form of genius. Like you just sit and you play it. Like I don't need someone to show me the fucking chords or read anything. Like
that's so amazing.
Right, and then the other thing is that, you know, if someone says, you know, like, okay, so we're doing this song. And they're like, I'd like to do it more like, and like, nah. I'll be just like, okay. Like, I just know. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I do.
I'm not explaining it well, but what I'm trying to say is that I'm a jukebox. I'm a transposer. I can play anything back. I know what note. Like, for example, sometimes I just can't listen to music because I know every note as it's playing. So it's like, I just want to tell everybody, like, no one can understand that unless, like, it's very hard for me to sort of shut off. Like, I have to focus on something else because otherwise I start to just know every single thing that's going on.
Right.
And that's really creepy and weird and exhausting. So it's different than, now let me go sing, you know, what's any song, you know? Like a bridge over the trouble. I will name it down. Now I'm about to listen to that back. Uh-huh. Was my pitch spot on? Maybe.
Probably.
Like, oh, it's not like I sang it and it was perfect. Like I listen to her sing, and to me, she's got one of the best voices, or Pink or whatever. It's like you can still be a little off when you're performing.
Sure.
You know, so it depends on what you're saying. What is perfect pitch? I'm talking about perfect pitch in the sense of like, I know what every note is. I may not sing
it.
I know what is going on globally, universally.
Yeah. Okay. That makes more sense. Instead of just hearing, okay, she's off, which you could probably tell anyway, like, okay, she's off key, but you can hear.
But
you can hear what something, you know exactly what notes are being played as it's happening.
Now, sometimes people are singing off pitch because they literally don't have any pitch.
Yeah.
Right. Like they can't hear pitch properly. I can, and I can irritate myself when for whatever reason, my throat is just not giving me my instrument that day. Mm-hmm. I just woke up. I've oversang. It's not as easy. Other days, it's a control thing with my voice. If I have complete control of my voice, then my pitch could be really great the whole time. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be people who, you know, like I said, my husband started later. So I remember in the beginning of our relationship, we were very young when we met, I'd be like, no, babe. And I'd keep showing him and pushing him. And he's slowly developed, I would say, incredible pitch in his own ear via like practicing, via the practice of being a musician. You know, even his singing, he has become a much, much more pitch oriented singer. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can start hearing it more.
You can start hearing it.
Yeah.
But for me, everything for me is engineered backwards. Like I started on 10 and I'm using it and I'm always trying to like pull back. Like I'm always trying to stay there. Whereas other people, I think they're moving forward and they're, you know what I mean? It's very hard to explain, but
that's fascinating.
My relationship with music is odd because I literally didn't have a choice. Like it overcame me. You know, can you imagine I'm 3-4 years old and I'm watching Sesame Street or The Electric Company and I'm just going back and forth to the piano and playing the songs that are being, you know, performed and like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
no, totally.
So early. So I've never known that story. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So of course it's what became my life, but but I think, there's curses involved with it. And you have to navigate those things, you know, whatever your luck.
Sure, sure. But with that, like, okay, so you obviously, this has been with you as long as you can remember, you know, you're playing at 2-3 years old.
Yeah.
Tell me about when you get signed to, you know, you get a first deal with Columbia Records. Like, was that always like you already kind of knew like, okay, well, I know I'm going to pursue music. This is like what I'm here to do. The record deal is just the next thing in, line.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I came from a really small place where, like I said, nothing happened to people like that. And at the same time, I was really dedicated to my craft and I was really dedicated to the arts. Did I have a plan? No, I had a few people who believed in me as I got older and older in my teens that, you know, that I had something really special and they had like a they were sitting on a bigger perch. You know what I mean? Like they could see Toronto, they could see the US, they could see bigger. And they were like, no, it doesn't matter where you're from. This is a talent. This person is talented. And I sort of was lucky to have those people. One of them was a guy called Chris Burt Gaffney. He was in a great, there's sort of a group of bands from Winnipeg. One of them is called, why do I always forget the name of it? They've got such a beautiful song. April Wine. They have this song, "Tonight is a wonderful time to fall in love." Oh yeah. And I mean, I always thought that song was like a huge world hit. It's not. Mm-hmm. It was like Manitoba, Saskatchewan, maybe. I don't know. And then there was this band called The Pumps, and they had an offshoot band called Orphan. And there was a song that Orphan had, and it was called Miracle. And it was one of my favorite songs and it was on all my mixtapes. And it would be right next to like U2 and The Fix, you know, or Talking Heads or whatever. And, you know, these huge, huge hit songs. And I thought that orphan song Miracle, is called Miracle, that it was the same level hit. Like, I didn't know, I was a kid. And then one day someone said to me, oh my gosh, that's Christopher Gaffney. And in like a cafe in Winnipeg, I was 19 and no 20, maybe 20. And I literally thought I was going to pee my pants, because in my head, Orphan was the most beautiful song ever written. Mm-hmm. And I walked up to him and I said, hi, I'm Chantal and I'm a songwriter and I'm a huge fan. And he was like this really, like, really lovely, decent man, a good guy who had his sights set on a future of developing artists and writing. You know, he's very much a collaborator. And I guess he thought I was, like, you know, pretty serious and took me seriously. And he said, well, let's have a meeting. And it was incredible. That was my break. That was my moment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I went and had, you know, sat at the piano with him, and we wrote more songs over time. And then we had another person involved that had a studio, and we recorded, we basically ended up with a demo tape that mm-hmm. you know, we sent off to a couple of labels, and that was it. I had a publishing deal and a record deal.
Wow.
And it was from in particular, a song I wrote called Surrounded. And mm-hmm. I have to say that the song, I think now, no offense to Chris, but I can't even listen to the demo. It's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life.
The demo or the one that made the record?
No, the demo.
Okay. The
demo. My first album, it's good. It's a tough thing, the first album. You know, that wasn't my second album. That in my head is, I wish was my first in a way, not the songs all necessarily, because I love all the songs I've written, like in my own solo career. I really love, I'm proud of them. But you know how the sound comes out, right? In the production. Mm-hmm. That's a tough thing for you, really, a really young person being sort of swept up, and everybody's got their vision. And I, you know, it's funny. I was asked to go with Eric Ross, who did Tori Amos's Under the Pink. And I almost went with Eric. And then I ended up going with Peter Asher and Matt Wallace. And there were all sorts of amazing things that came of that for my first album. But I blame myself. I didn't have a lot of the language that one needs.
Mm-hmm.
And points of reference mm-hmm. in order to show what I wanted.
Sure.
And so I just did a lot of crying by myself.
Oh, because you couldn't express to them exactly what you were going for.
And also it's like, I signed a record deal in February. Can you imagine this? Recorded at the top studios all over Los Angeles, including Conway, A&M, my friends became, you know, Adam Sandler and Keanu Reeves, and, you know, I was like literally next door to both of those acts while I was recording my album. Like, I mean, this was my new life. And by September, I had an album out and I was traveling around the world with Sony.
Gosh.
So it was too much for me to, you know, I didn't have the same experience, say, as Alanis, where she went around to like hundreds of studios and people.
Mm-hmm.
And worked with lots of people, and then finally hit it when she and Glenn met. Like, that was mm-hmm. her person. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it has to do with me just not really having the language, and also, like, there was no women back then. Maybe a woman who answered the phone at A&M. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it was a lot of men, and it's like, Chantal, here's your band. This is your studio band, and it was like,
Some guy
showed up in like crazy leather pants that was like getting paid, you know, $1,500 a day, and thought his shit didn't stink. He was a fucking asshole to me. I was always having anxiety about being in a room with him, but I didn't feel good about saying anything. He's probably a lovely guy. I couldn't process things well, and felt his aloofness was, you know, he hated it. It was bizarre. Like,
what an intimidating situation.
Very intimidating. Yeah.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
And then there would be someone else that I did get along with, and then I would feel bad that I was thinking about all sorts of things, except now I get in the studio. It's like, dude, I've got three kids. I have 2 hours. Let's write a hit song.
let's get the hell out of here.
Like, I'm just going to assume we love each other. We don't need to tickle one another. Like, let's just get our shit done. It's a very different thing now, right?
Sure. Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a lot. I feel like I had a little bit more magic in terms of dynamics on the second album. when I recorded with Jay Joyce. Do you know Jay Joyce? He's in Nashville. You got to look him up. You got to interview him.
I will.
He's Emmy Lou Harris's guy for the most part
for
I think at least production, if not writing.
Write his name down right now.
He is just one of the most talented forces of nature imaginable. And he's, you know, it's funny because the second album, it also, my A&R person must have thought, you know, Mike Roth was his name. That's who signed me. He must have really thought it was important that the piano was complemented by the guitar. Because my both of those albums were very guitar heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But on the second album, it was done differently. It had a little more progressive sounding, which I think was what I was looking for in my head, and I couldn't explain it. So, yeah.
So just working with a different person do you feel like also that you weren't as green to the situation now?
Because
you put a record out.
Confidence.
Yeah.
I had my footing a little more. Now I'd met my husband. By the time I was recording my second album, I think I was living with my husband and I had a sounding board. I had a personal sounding board for the first time in my life.
Uh-huh.
Imagine, like I'd never to that day had someone I went home to and sat and who would like give me a lyric or like,
right.
Try that, you know, go somewhere, like a different perspective. Never. I never had that until that moment.
That's interesting. And because his band had already taken off at that point, right? When you guys had met.
Well, no. So what's interesting is that when I met Rain, I didn't know Our Lady Peace.
Oh, you didn't.
In fact, I remember I was sitting, we met at a Pearl Jam concert I saw him behind me when I sat down. He was so cute. And I said to the label president who happened to be sitting next to me, I said, you know, who's that? And he goes, oh, that's Rain from Our Lady Peace. And I just thought he had just said such a strange mouthful of like, I don't know, Eastern or Indian
words.
Or
Iranian words.
Like I didn't know what he'd said. And I just said, yeah, introduce us, you know. And when he introduced us, that was it for Rain and I. We had a very strong friendship for several months, but we really liked each other a lot. And I was sort of in his life suddenly while he was recording Clumsy.
Wow. So
he was bringing home the
demos
recordings
for Clumsy.
Of the day, you know, I would get to listen to them like in his car late at night or something like that after the studio. At that point, Naveed had been out.
Okay.
So, you know.
Wow. But yeah, still, I mean, to hear it. So he's bringing home like Superman's dad and those early recordings.
When he put out, I remember being outside his mom's in the car and listening to Carnival.
Okay.
I think that's what it was called. And I was like,
yeah, Carnival's the song on that record. It must be that one.
Yeah, it's like, it's like.
Yeah.
I gotta cover that song.
You should. You should give it to him for his birthday or something. That'd be awesome.
I love that song. But I remember sonically sitting in his car, he had a Nissan Pathfinder. And it was dark and oh my God, it just brings back so many memories. Just think of how that felt. To hear that song. Yeah, so I was listening to all those songs before they came out, and then of course the album is, you know, and I've never known anything different, you know. That's the boyfriend. He has a crazy, you know, huge hit record. And I have his records too. So we were kind of we met when each other was I met him on the first day I'd ever been to Toronto, I think. I didn't have a friend yet. I invited the makeup artist from the video shoot that day to come with me to the Pearl Jam concert because I was given 6 tickets and I didn't know anybody. So I gave the other 4 away. They were somewhere else in the arena.
Uh-huh.
And I sat next to Rain. I sat in front of Rain with this girl.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so amazing.
He was basically one of the very first people I met. What a dummy.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And then, I mean, obviously you've been married for what, 20 years?
2 years.
18 years?
This year is 22 years or 22 years.
Oh my gosh.
And together 26.
Wow. And when do you guys start writing music and putting music together? Pretty early on? Or I mean, you didn't really release anything as a project till recently.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is a birthplace for sure of us playing together. I think the real birthplace is when he started being my sounding board. Okay. You know, I remember I was writing a song called Time. I don't remember if he's credited as a writer on it. I think he is, because he helped me with that. Or he helped, that was on my third album. On my second album, which I told you now, I already had my first album, The Can. I was shooting my video for my first single the day I met him. But for second album, my cousin passed. And that was the one who I was always, you know, singing and dancing to Fleetwood Mac with. And she was more like my sister. So it was a really devastating thing, and still is. And so I wrote a song called Far Away about Brenda. And I can remember that, you know, I would be stuck somewhere and I would show it to him. I can remember being very nervous showing him, you know, and asking him. And he was busy with his own shit, but he was like, oh, that's great. You should say this there or something. Like he would give me, you know, a nudge with one word or, you know, or he'd say, that's great. Stop. Like, why are you writing another part? You see there's four parts there or something. Like he just started becoming somebody I could collaborate with. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, without sounding like a jerk, I'm sure there was stuff also as we were living together that, you know, with Our Lady Peace, and he always recorded everything at home. He was doing a lot of it. You know, there was stuff with the band, but he was the driving force of the writing. Mm-hmm. And I would say stuff. I would suggest things in front of him, in front of the band, and they may or may not take something. I don't know. But there was just a respect, you know, even though we were very much our own forces and our own careers and our own musical minds. And then the big probably, I mean, the two big game changers were that he started making a couple solo albums when the children were really little. He made one called Hunter's Lullaby, which is just absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And he did another one called We All Get Lighter, and that was an EP. But I was his Linda Ronstadt on those. So I wasn't really writing on them. Mm-hmm. I was just putting in like the Elvis backgrounds.
Gotcha.
Background vocals. And I it was a real neat reprieve. That the kids were in and out of the studio with that all the time because we were doing that. Or he started producing my albums, you know, like.
Yeah, because you were still putting out records after you guys had met and everything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You're still kind of
I have 9 solo and he has 10 with Our Lady Peace. So yeah.
Yeah.
And
okay.
then And then when he went on, he wanted a tour. So we did some touring together and I was his background singer, piano player. And then he'd come on tour with me and open for me as a solo artist because I was selling out my, you know, bigger venues. And so then he had that. And then I would go out with him in the States and he could, you know, draw crowds, obviously, from his history all over the States. And and so that was the beginning of, I think, playing together and also finding a sound together. Because when I look back on those albums he made, Moon versus Sun isn't that much of a stretch from Rain's solo stuff and my collaboration with him on that. There's something. Now, is there something obviously very different? There's something else when Moon versus Sun now sits down. It's like, we know what we are.
Right.
I'm not appearing or guesting on Rain Made Up. That's different too. His production on his own stuff is very progressive compared to like the more organic feel that Moon versus Sun is. Then the next thing that happened was as we became an old married couple, people would invite us to play together at like charitable events and stuff like that, fundraisers and so on. And you know, we'd get up together and I can remember I would say to him, we need a song together. Because he'd be playing the guitar when I would sing before you, and I would be playing the piano, and he was doing Superman's Dead or something, and it was like, okay. Hey, we need an us song to bridge.
Sure,
it.
Sure.
And and then there was a song that we were listening to a lot by Sage Francis called Sun versus Moon, and it was kind of a bit of a theme song around our home, just an absolute stunner. And Sage is a spoken word poet, but has such a musicality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
He's amazing.
I've seen him live a few times, and he comes out with
spiritual experience.
He comes out with like a jacket with all the different corporation companies like all over it and everything.
Anarchist, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that song, it was so beautiful, and Sun versus Moon, and then Rain was saying like maybe we're Moon versus Sun, you know, and then. Then we were born. And then one night we recorded one song, the one called I Love It When You Make Me Beg. And we really felt, you know, the way that we ended up sort of getting to where we made a documentary about our fucked upness and collaborating was that when we wrote the song, I Love It When You Make Me Beg, it was so big and bold and beautiful, and it knew what it was. And it was like, oh my God, we gotta do 6, 8, 10 of these pronto. But then it was busy. And every time I'd say, are we going to go in? It'd be like, oh my God, we'd end up falling asleep, or, you know, have to fill out forms for the kids, blah, 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 or whatever. Like it's just, or someone was traveling or, and so it just wasn't happening. And it became like, we had a friend who, Amy, who is a producing partner on the film. She really felt that she'd seen us play live together. And she, like, she'd been at a function or something. And she was like, you two have such an amazing dynamic on stage. Because we sort of fight on stage and make jokes and it's cute. She goes, you should really, we need to film that when you decide to finally make your album together. And we kind of took that and we thought, you know, we should. And maybe if we have the crew hired and everybody's ready to go, then we can't cancel. And we'll be sequestered and alone.
I like that.
And in my head, I thought it would be really romantic. But leading up to the leaving, we weren't doing so well as a couple. So we thought we should do some topping up with our marriage coach. And then it became this thing of like, well, have the marriage coach in the thing. Hi, Sal. Have the marriage coach in the film. It's meaningful stuff. And I think most marriages could use a Dr. John.
Sure.
And so it became a little bit of a movement in our minds. What if we could move the needle a little bit for people as to what hope there was in their marriages? And maybe it wasn't a stretch that collaborating as a couple could be similar to collaborating as artists. Maybe it's not much different. Maybe there's a respect that's required. Maybe there's a balance of space and voice, and there's equity,
right,
in these relationships, and they function, you know. And Rain and I, we probably did need a lot of work even as artists collaborating together, but when we're on stage and we sing together and we are performing together, it's kind of magical. We have a very magical dynamic that way. So that was sort of our hope always. You know what I'm saying? That was almost like that's our starting point or our anchor or our, yeah, it's our hope. It's our hopeful place, our strong point.
Sure.
So, and it's, we have that advantage, you know, as a couple. We have something that can sort of almost like bitch slap us and tell us, you know, there's always something better that you can do. So if that was the standard, we had some work to do in our private space as a couple, and even as collaborators, we had some work to do. The truth is that, you know, documentaries don't say everything going on.
Of course, yeah.
They don't. And so the truth is there's more than I want to share that's there. We're in a bad place in that island for a couple of reasons. One is how cold it is and how far we were from the children. I personally never accounted for how depressed that I would be away from our children.
It was I didn't even think about it. So they didn't come with you. I haven't seen the film. I've just seen the trailer. Wow. Okay. So it was just the two of you and the crew.
And I was hateful. I was a raging mother bear. I could not handle it. And then another truth that it doesn't show is, you know, Dr. John has been our coach for a dozen years. And we have had great come to Jesus stuff in our life as a result of working with John. But the thing about marriage is that the work is never done.
Right.
That's why we wrote a song called The Work that is now on this album. It's not in the film, The Work. It came after, but we really love it. To us, it really summarizes the whole thing. And it's funny how that song came sort of retrospectively. I think it's in a few interviews we've done already, that's the gem of the album. And I'm like, oops, that came. It's not in the film. It's after.
That's crazy.
But yeah. It is a special one. And, you know, when you start digging into the dynamics of family and marriage and repeating of cycles and all that stuff, you do learn. This is not something you fix and then it's done. This is work on yourself. This is co-regulation. This is stuff that you'll do your whole life. Mm-hmm. It will be your toolkit, you know? So when we left for Saint-Pierre and when we were there, I would describe that as an off the rails point where we needed work and we weren't doing the work.
When you got there or when you left?
We weren't in a great place when we left and then it worsened. And we knew we weren't in a great place. So we tried to do top up work with our coach and had him join us so we would be prepared to go to Saint-Pierre. But for whatever reason, when the cameras turned on in Saint-Pierre, we were some stuff had gone on and it just went from bad to worse. And I mean, you know, ultimately I think it made for a good music documentary. Jason Hirshhorn today in his daily, whatever he does, his blog. He described it as mini, are you there? Sorry.
Yeah.
As the mini, some kind of monster.
Okay.
Mini monster, something like that. And that's what it is. And I don't know. And I don't know that we would have gotten the songs that we got. Like we worked through our issues in the music. So that's why this album is what it is. And I think it's a beautiful album. And sometimes beautiful stuff comes from horrible crap. I don't know.
Sure. Well, it's what's interesting is that you guys kind of set aside this time to go, you know, seclude yourself. And like literally, you know, what, a year after, the whole world forces everyone to do just
same
that.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, man, there are tools in that film. I mean, listen, I'm not going to judge your whole empty apartment and your thing with your wife not being here, but I think you and your wife can sit down with a glass of wine and watch that film. Okay.
We will. We will. I'm curious. I don't know. Maybe was this supposed to come out before the pandemic? Cause I've seen some interviews with you guys prior.
Actually, it was geofenced in Canada.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Where we're from and very well, you know, received. It was on HBO. And the album's been out and it's been very impactful. Very impactful.
Because the album just came out here on the 23rd. Last week.
Yeah.
Okay. That's where I was trying to put it all together. I'm like, did I miss something? Because I'm watching these like YouTube interviews with you guys from like January of 2019.
Well, that has to do with the fact that it's not like you snap your fingers, you put it on iTunes and you promote. It was too much work. And we wanted to do something special and make sure that it had the right home and opportunities. And I think, you know, I don't know. I think it's probably meant to have worked out as it did because we are in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And people do need this kind of source. Art source, you know, right now. So
it's like you guys did this before it all happened. It's kind of like you can kind of, it's in a weird sense, like you can show people like how you dealt with it, like at the time, not even thinking that obviously a year or two later, everyone would be in a similar situation.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, when you guys wrote the record in the film, was the project already going to be Moon versus Sun at this point, or was it like, okay, let's do this and I'm going to break your heart. It's going to be a film. And okay. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to break your heart.
Or I'm going to break your heart. Sorry.
Song. It was just a song we're working on. And so we bring that idea we had into the sessions in Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. And we talk about it. It becomes actually, you need to see the film.
I know, because it just came out here.
Okay, so, well, I can't talk you through this without it's hard. Like the I'm going to break your heart. There's a, I don't want to give it away. I don't want to be a spoiler, but the stuff that comes up while we're writing that song becomes a kind of a major plot in the film.
Got you. Okay.
Because we are having impasses throughout the film. That's a major one.
Okay.
As artists, we do not agree about what the structure of that song is supposed to be. So funny. Someone on YouTube, we were on Seth Meyers, and I couldn't stay up. I was tired. So I went on YouTube and I watched it today, and it was like thousands of people had already watched it and comment, and people commenting. I'm like, oh shit. So I looked at the comments. Never look at the comments. Somebody was like, this is a completely self-indulgent, shallow and petty situation, this film. Can't believe they did it. Shame. And like shame on them. It was just,
right, of course.
Just an utterly like, just a review of vitriol. And they weren't even like talking about the Seth Meyers performance. No, they were just excited to have an opportunity to say how bad our film was.
Wow. And like, some people, it's like, yeah, but really?
But you know what? I thought about it. And well, first of all, I commented back.
Good.
Yeah, my comment back was something like, this film arouses a response in each person that is very subject to their own personal experience in marriage and collaboration.
There you go.
Therefore, you sound quite self-realized and above us. Congratulations.
Well,
yeah, that's the nice passive aggressive Canadian way. But,
I love that.
But as I thought of it later, the thing is that you could watch this film and be like, oh my God, these people are crazy. They are fighting over the bridge of a song, right? These people are crazy. Look at how massive their egos are. Like they can't, like, I can see that. I can totally see watching these two married artists that like you could just want to throw up. I mean, you have to see it, okay?
I'm going
But I had this other thought about it. I was like, well, no, because this is my life. Mm-hmm. I don't go to a factory or hospital or a school and teach. Like, I don't have that life. This is my life. Writing songs and performing music, hustling songs, peddling songs. That's my life, you know? So to one person, yeah, that might just seem ridiculous.
Right.
Oh, that's my life.
Right. Exactly. That's your career. That's all, that's what you do. And that's what you're passionate about. And
all I have, that's, you know, yeah, that's everything.
Exactly.
So, that's all I've ever known since mm-hmm. I was born. So, oh, well, you know, I can remember someone else came to the film, a friend, and he's sort of an influential promoter where I'm from. And we had like an event for my hometown, for Bill's Town. And he came back that stage after. He goes, I have to go home, blah, blah, blah. But he's like, I have no idea why you made that movie. Bye, I love you. And he left. My husband was like, who is that guy? You know?
Yeah.
I'm from a very meat and potatoes kind of place. It's also got an artistic element to it. But mm-hmm. it's sort of strange. Like, I watched my brother-in-law just sob and sob watching the film, how cathartic it was for him. Or my parents just love it. Or for some people, I think it's cringeworthy. For other people, it's cathartic. It brings up your own experience and dynamics with marriage and you know, familial relations. It can be really hard to watch.
I can't wait to see it. And I love that you, obviously, like I said, this podcast started as a thing with my wife and I,
yeah.
and that you guys have this project together as husband and yeah. wife.
And I believe that honestly, that's what actually nature wants. Like, nature wants Joe and Jill Biden and Kamala Harris. Nature wants equity, everyone represented, the female, male, whatever that is. I don't care if you're trans, you're gay. Like, I don't care, but mm-hmm. everyone represented, because sure. you know, we have lived in a patriarchy. We live in misogyny in our various careers and lives. It shows up everywhere for us. So this film has undercurrents My husband's a total dude. He's an Italian. He's a total dude, but he's also an artist and he's a progressive person. So he cannot deny certain things.
Sure.
And so he's allowing that openness. He has an openness. He's the hero of the film. He takes one for the team big time. Because for a woman, I have women write me and be like, leave that fucking asshole, you know? Jeez. And then I have men who are like, women write me and say, my husband and I are in a fight. He will not watch the film. He watched the first three. He's so angry. Like it brings up a lot for people because it's a man kind of saying, hey, here I am. There's no equity. We need equity. Like it's mm-hmm. so poetic how it's done, but it's a bit of a game changer about our roles and like about society. Mm-hmm. It's deep.
Well, I cannot wait.
It's not shallow and petty.
All right. Well, like exactly. I didn't think it would be. Well, since this film was done, you know, a couple of years ago, or at least over a year ago, have you guys been working on? Well, like, is this project going to continue? Obviously, with like another record, or you live, you know, you work
you
together.
You sound like the label.
Oh, so I'm sorry. No, I'm just curious because I love the album. I was listening to it earlier today, and so I'm like, whoa, okay, well, this it's. And like I said, I got kind of confused with the geofencing of the film. And right. I'm like, okay, well, this is supposed to go together. Okay, well, this is obviously a project. What are they continuing this? Or I did see, I mean, yeah. Your husband has a record coming out or was working on a record, yeah. I think, for Our Lady Peace. Weird. And you released a record in 2020.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot going on.
I know. Right?
Where does this sit?
Yeah, it's interesting. But I think of people like, you know, like, Leslie Feist, who is Feist, and she has broken social scene mm-hmm. too. Like, I think it's a project that we love and that we are very committed to. And honestly, I think it's, if I might speak for my husband, like this is for the duration, you know? Sure. But we can't plan the future. We don't know things, but we know that we love it. And we know that we found our sound and our footing, and it's a beautiful thing for our relationship. It kind of reflects, you know, a belief that kind of comes in. If you do a lot of work in marriage, you come to realize that a marriage where the partners don't have something that they do together truly is a dead marriage. It's a dead marriage walk-in. And I think Moon versus Sun is something that while maybe we'll fight our way through it for the rest of our life, it's something that on a sort of big level, we very much agree upon it, right? Mm-hmm. And we're both very passionate about it, and it's ours. And that's beautiful. So it's on. Like, don't be prone.
I love that. I love it. Yeah. I can't wait to see the film. And I really appreciate you doing this today, Chantel. I have one more question for you.
Yes.
Do you have any advice for aspiring artists?
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah. Remember when I said at the beginning, I was like, I don't have advice because it's all forms of luck. well, you know, I will say this because it's something that I'm continually learning.
Okay.
It always comes back. If you're not, you can think a lot of shit in your head about what you are or what your vision is, what you think you know, who you think you know. But if you're not doing it and you're not showing it and you're not showing up with the goods and you're not practicing it and it's not physically occurring, you got nothing. You got to go and put in, you know, go get your minutes. Like my kids' coaches, they all talk about minutes on the basketball court. It's all about minutes. So you just have to keep on. Like you just got to, you know, I guess it's stupid cliche now, right? Is become a master. And everyone's journey is different. And that's something that's born of you. You're a snowflake. I mean, everyone's different. Some people are great at a particular instrument, and that eventually leads them into the writing zone or into, you know, touring or what have you. And then the next thing they know, they're the artist. I don't know. Like it comes different for everyone. But whatever it is, you have to practice it. And when I say practice, I don't mean like you're home alone practicing. I mean the practice of it. Get out there. Do it. Make mistakes. Who cares? I always think of this one story. Shh, quiet. I think of this one story where I was, you know, I was sort of bumped into Drake one night, and they were like, okay, let's go back to the studio. Let's make some music. He was making his first song after his EP for Take Care, you know? And you know, I ended up singing and producing on and writing, co-writing, but, you know, the first song of the album, Take Care, which is Over My Dead Body. And I'll tell you, I'd had some really crappy sessions for the several months prior. And I remember when I came home to LA, because that was in Toronto, and we'd ended up staying in the studio for on and off over the week and getting the song going. And I said to Ray, he said, how was it? And I said, you know, it was so great because it made every crappy session I did that year make sense. That's how that song was born, of a heaping pile of steamy crap. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just have to go through it. There's no way around it. It's hard work. It's an isolating job. It's isolating work to be an artist. And then also live your life. Don't kill yourself over it. It's not worth it. You're going to get so jerked around. Oh my God, I've got stories. Oh my God. Someone told me the other day, they listened to a podcast where the person who screwed me around the most yet in the music business in the past 20 years, she got on her podcast and she said, they said, well, why are you really songwriting anymore? And her response was, you know, after a while, it just ripped my heart out too much. It was just too competitive. And that was coming from the person that myself and dozens of other victims have lived, you know, through her brand of torture. So that's what I'm talking about. This business is tough. Because if she thinks she got screwed around and it was too competitive for her, that's amazing. So you got to be tough, and you have to find your love and your joy and your laughter. I love to go to watch comedians do stand up, and you got to keep the light on, man, because it's tough. Don't take it too seriously. You have to work hard.